Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Doing fantastic. Excited to be here. A little post-game pod action. We always bring the energy on these, so I'm excited to see where we land. Thank you to Errol, the Dunkers. Thank you for embracing your bounce. Nikias, I'm very interested to see how you get to Mr. ABO versus your Bucks pick, but we'll get to that later.
We will get to that relatively soon. First, I would like to say I enjoyed your appearance on The Haber Show with Tom Haberstroh and Mr. Amin Al-Hassan. It was very entertaining. I was kind of debating if I wanted to bring up some references from the pod or if I want to just direct our dunkers to that podcast so they could hear them all. But I would just say very vaguely that the end of the pod was hilarious. Just you have a way with words.
What I did. You got to tell me.
I'll tease it for the folks to go check out the episode. It was great. But I would just say you have a way with words. This is a great way to cap off the Ben Simmons discussion and such. I don't know how much I can talk around this without saying what the line was. But really enjoyed you on the pod.
There's different phases in life, Nikias. We all have to go through them.
Ah, there it is. Okay, that's all. We are good to go. Speaking of good to go, we got some coaching news since the last time we talked. Rick Carlisle is going to Indiana, a four-year, $29 million contract. Ime Udoka is going to be hired as the next head coach of the Boston Celtics. He is not the first head coach of color in Boston, contrary to, I don't even want to call it popular belief, but we'll leave that alone. And it would appear that the Dallas Mavericks are also making a hire. Jason Kidd seems to be in the lead, if he doesn't have a pen to paper already. So we can start with Indiana. How do you feel about the hiring?
I think it's a good hire. Rick Carlisle can coach. I don't think there's anyone who's going to say he can't, especially with what he's done in the league. I was a little surprised he went back to Indiana because he's already been there. But it was clear Indiana was going to look for veteran coach this time. They weren't going to go back to the first time deal. They tried that. It's interesting. They had Nate McMillan, but they let him go. But you end up with Rick Carlisle. Now, the interesting part to me is I wonder how that affected their search, because I think the initial list of names, it had the veteran names, it had people we expected as far as what they're looking to get to. But then Rick Carlisle becomes available and they kept that on the lowest of lows, like the lowest of lows. And I guess that's why you send out a notes app when you leave the Dallas Mavericks job. But I'm not going to say too much on that. But when you have a coach of that caliber available, you got to go after him. But you've just started your interview process. And that's where it gets tricky, because I saw the backlash as far as, hey, did they not vet it? Is this like the Minnesota thing? Rick Carlisle came out and blasted the Minnesota deal. How's this happening? The coaching searches change as the dominoes shift, the market shifts. And for me, I feel bad for Terry Stotts, because Rick Carlisle edged him out of one spot. So now it's like, where does he land? Does he land this season type deal? But I think Carlisle is going to do well. I'm interested to see what he does with this roster. Sabonis, obviously, you can put him in a whole lot of different places. You can play in the half court. You can play with pace. And I want to see how it works, because Carlisle can play with pace, can play with tempo, but he can also go half court and run some sets. So what he does with Sabonis, what he does with LeVert, what he does with Brogdon, I want to see what that looks like. But overall, good hire. If you're looking to take a step up in the East, get a veteran coach like that, can't beat it.
I am with you. I think it is a good hire, at least on the basketball / X's and O's side. Like, Rick Carlisle is a legend, one of the best coaches we've seen, one of the best coaches in the league still. I am also curious about how he's going to fit with this roster. As you mentioned, he can play with pace. He can slow it down. Indiana didn't really find their flow at all this season, which, COVID played into that, injuries played into that. But I don't know. Like, I've seen them try to push the pace this season, and it didn't always look great until, like, the second half of the season where they were scoring a bunch of points and couldn't stop anybody. But not being able to stop anybody also was, like, a common theme of the season for them for a multitude of reasons. So I wonder what that's going to look like. I also wonder what that means for the front court in particular. Like, you mentioned the usage of Sabonis, but, like, I feel like there's been a Sabonis or Turner thing kind of simmering underneath the surface in Indiana for years now. So I wonder if Carlisle's presence means there, if he wants to try to make that Turner Sabonis pairing work with the rest of the roster, or if they do want to split it up, where does he go with that? Like, that's really question number one for me. On the other side, it's just, as reports came out about Carlisle leaving and stuff, talked about his relationship with Luka and how, I don't want to say volatile, that's too strong of a word, but like how testy he kind of got between those two, and just Rick Carlisle's nature in general. Like, he seems to be more of a tough coach, and he's entering an Indiana situation that just dealt with Nate Bjorkgren, and the locker room didn't seem to take too kindly to him in the way that he operated. So I wonder what that process is going to be like as well, just kind of ingratiating himself to locker room. I mean, just again, from a basketball perspective, like, Rick Carlisle is a home run hire for them. But I am wondering, like, what the roster is going to look like, and also just how he's going to fit into that locker room.
It's interesting you bring up the Sabonis Turner combo, because Carlisle in Dallas has not been afraid to play two bigs, but he likes to play two bigs who have complementary skill sets. So one big who can roll, one big who can shoot in space. And Indiana has tried that with Turner and Sabonis, and it's been a mixed bag. I think we can all say that. Mm-hmm. It feels like both of them get in each other's way, where we see what they can do when the other's not on the floor. But for whatever reason, when they're together, it's just kind of a big bag of uh-oh, I guess I'll say. Mm-hmm. So that'll be interesting to see if they keep Miles Turner and how they use them together. It'd be a shame if TJ McConnell ends up leaving this year, considering what Rick Carlisle does with point guards, especially off the bench.
Yes.
Also, I think this seals Doug McDermott is gone. Mm. That didn't go so well.
This is true. Yeah, he ended up pretty buried on the bench during that year.
Under the ground.
Well, they've got a shooter on the market. But yeah, like, I don't know what you do at the front court, honestly. Because to your point, like, it has been a mixed bag with those two. It just feels like Sabonis is not good enough to anchor at the five defensively. And Turner, as stretch adjacent as he can be, he's not a stretch five. Like, early in his career, it's, why are you taking these 20 and a half footers instead of just taking the step back? You know, this is something that I've mentioned on the podcast before. And this season, we saw him take less of those and more of those above the break threes, and the percentages didn't carry over. And beyond the percentages not carrying over, like, the volume was higher, but still not high enough, and teams largely let him shoot still. So, like, at a certain point, it's nice if you can knock down open threes, and I do think Turner can't shoot. But, like, if teams are giving you, like, a soft closeout, or they're just letting you shoot, then what is that really doing to the offense? So I wonder, again, just going back to my original point, like, I wonder if he's going to give that pairing a try. Because I think with an offseason, like, if you get some improved shooting from Turner, maybe he does become that 37% three-point shooter on, like, five attempts or something. Just throwing some numbers out there. But maybe he does become that kind of a threat. And maybe that loosens up the half court just enough to maximize both of those guys. And you don't have to make a move. But I also wonder, with the sample that they've had already, if this is something Carlisle's like, no, let's just build it around Sabonis, or let's sell high on Sabonis. Let's keep Turner, since he was in defensive player of the year race for most of the season. He's that caliber defender. Like, maybe he prioritizes that, and you try to, again, if he wants to go more of a pace style, maybe you try to fill it in that way. Like, TJ Warren's coming back. He gave them some really good play last season, in particular when he got to play the four before getting hurt. So I don't know. Like, there are a lot of different directions going with that Indiana team. I'm really intrigued.
As am I. The other intriguing thing was Ime Udoka to Boston. What did you think of that? It was a historic moment.
Oh, man, I am very proud of Ime Udoka being a barrier breaker in Boston in particular. Something we have not seen before. I can't even keep up with the bit. Oh, man. In all seriousness, that's great for Ime Udoka. Like, his name has been floating around coaching searches for years now. Like, he's a very highly regarded assistant. Has some experience with Team USA, if I'm not mistaken. So, like, he's been around a lot of talented programs, been under Pop, been around a lot of star players. With that Team USA connection, he's obviously been around Jason Tatum, even with him just being on, like, the select team or just being in training camp. So he has that relationship there. I'm interested to see what he does with Boston.
Now, shout out to a Portland, Oregon legend, Ime Udoka. I thought that was a good hire in the sense that I don't know if you want to bring in a veteran coach to that situation with Brad Stevens as the executive just coming off as coach. So you bring in Udoka, who has the experience, and it's been time. Like, it's been time for him to get this step. And you allow him to use his experience as a coach, as a player, to connect with the players. And hopefully you see how that goes. Now, it'll be interesting to see how he grows as a coach. But this is a pretty good situation. You get Tatum, you get Brown, and you can move forward from there. Hopefully they'll add more to the roster. But I'm mostly just happy that he finally got the shot that he's deserved in this league.
It is long overdue for him. I was kind of curious to see what Boston was going to do with the coaching search in general. Because, like, you just made the point you didn't think it was the spot for a veteran coach. And, like, I'm also kind of the mind, like, I don't know if you go completely new. Like, I don't think you take, like, the Mark Danigault route in OKC or anything like that. So I was interested to see if they were going to try to thread the needle. Like, we talked about it on the last pod, once Rick Carlisle and all the stuff happened in Dallas, I was like, well, this seems like a natural spot. Like, he already has the history there in Boston, but also this is a guy that has won a title, has many, you know, has plenty of experience in the game. Like, I feel like with the leap that Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown both made this season, like, maybe the rest of the roster needs to be reconfigured, but those two are very talented and ready to win now. And, like, they've had early playoff success in their careers already. So maybe you just kind of go with that and say, all right, let's make the push now. So I do think Ime Udoka, with the experience that he's had as an assistant, obviously first head coaching job, but, like, he's been around winning for a large chunk of his coaching career. And it is a fresh face. So I think that's the way to kind of thread the needle between the two, where you have some experience, you also have some youthfulness, you have some freshness there, and he already has kind of the relationships already. So I'm excited for him, excited to see how that situation grows.
I know you're excited about what happened in Dallas too.
Excited is one way to put it, yes.
Just kidding.
Unbelievable. That I'm mad that that's the first one of the pod. That's terrible. I am confused. Like, first, I'm just kind of like, what happened with Jamal Mosley? Is my first question. My second question is, like, who is this mysterious GM, president of basketball operations or whatever, that we keep hearing that Mark Cuban has talked to, and the unknown person has signed off on a Jason Kidd hire if it happens? Who is this?
Nico Harrison from Nike. I'm not saying a bad word at all.
Okay.
Because I know. But the mystery GM was weird. That was a weird deal during all of it. It was like, the Mavs are progressing with Jason Kidd, and it has the approval of the unnamed new president of basketball operations. And that was like, I mean, that's good, but, like, who is it? Like, I thought it was going to be Tyson Chandler for at least 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. Just because, you know, Dirk came back, and then Jason Kidd comes back. Then I thought it would be Jason Terry. But no, it's not. Left field.
I don't get, like, even, like, I saw the name out there. Like, I'm just now learning about who he is over the past couple hours or so. But, like, even as that started to come out, is he actually going to be the GM, or is he just joining the front office? Because I haven't seen that clarified.
Well, I assume he'd be the guy, and maybe he'll have a GM under him. But he's clearly, if he joins, would be the guy as far as making the basketball decisions. It's a copycat league. You saw what the Knicks did, and now that's a thing. Hey, let's find the person who has relationships and see how that goes and put some people around him to enhance that. Like, it's just the, like, it's the league is so in that manner. You have success with something, someone else is going to try it.
I guess we'll see on that front. Beyond, I don't get it with Jason Kidd.
Which part?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, well, before you go, it's kind of incredible. This is Jason Kidd's third shot. And let's be honest, we knew he was going to get another shot. He became assistant coach, goes to the Lakers, wins the title. But he was going to get another shot. But he gets that Brooklyn team, then he gets Giannis, then he gets Luka. You better win, buddy.
What does he do? It's kind of where I land on Jason Kidd. Because the Brooklyn tenure was weird. The Milwaukee trip had one interesting season, and it went left very quickly. He was an assistant with the Lakers, but like, what was his role exactly? Like, what are we saying he's the one that juiced the offense alongside Frank Vogel? Because we know what Frank Vogel brings defensively. Like, is that the argument we're making with Jason Kidd? And so with that, I'm just like, why is he getting the Luka job?
Because he used to play for Dallas.
I've got nothing.
Got him. Got him, folks.
It's a very odd hire.
Well, this will be interesting because I don't know what type of team works best for Jason Kidd. We saw what happened with a quote-unquote younger team in Milwaukee, and we've seen what he did with a quote-unquote veteran team in Brooklyn. This is kind of an in-between. So can he reach Luka at a different level, and can he embrace the others? Can he get the most out of the others? Because he did get a lot out of a lot of players in Milwaukee, but obviously eventually hit its ceiling, and that was that. So I'm intrigued. I'll put it that way. I'm intrigued by what could happen with that hire. I think for me, Dallas is getting people they trust. I told you Mark Cuban's going to fix this real quick, and he moved real quick. I mean, I think the first thing he did was like, yo, Dirk is back. Yo, Dirk is back. Now, yo, Jason Kidd.
I mean, sure, I guess. I mean, you can't go wrong with making sure that Dirk is involved. Like, easily the most important and also most beloved player in franchise history. So if you can get him and get his face out there, especially with this kind of blowing up randomly. Again, no, Donnie's out. Rick Carlisle's out. Like, the organization itself has been through some hashtag things over the past couple few years. So, like, any kind of goodwill you can ingratiate is a positive, which is also why I don't understand Jason Kidd being the choice if you're trying to improve the fanfare or make people feel better about the type of organization that's being run. But
so you're saying this hire is mid?
Yeah, I think it's mid. We'll see what happens when games are actually played. But on the surface, I can't pretend to be a fan of it.
Speaking of fans, are you a fan of Team USA? The 12-man roster is out for the Olympics. And this on paper looks like a Nekias Duncan built team in my eyes, with the exception of one player. But I'm interested to get your thoughts on Team USA. We know the squad. No fake tryouts.
We do know the squad. I guess the caveat I would throw out with Devin Booker being one of the people in particular, like, I would assume if the Suns make the finals, which they have a 2-1 lead in their series right now, then depending on how deep that series goes, like, maybe Devin Booker doesn't play. So we'll just have to see, you know, see who his replacement would be. But just to refresh the listeners, the team is in alphabetical order since I have the graphic here. Bam Adebayo's on this team. Bradley Beal, Devin Booker, Kevin Durant. Jeremy Grant, the good Grant. Draymond Green.
Wow. Holiday. Let me check his age real quick.
What is that? I don't think that's a check his age thing. I mean, he's not in the league right now. But Drew Holiday, Zach LaVine, Damian Lillard, Kevin Love, Chris Middleton, and Jason Tatum is the squad.
28 years old. This does not track.
There was no age slander. It's Jeremy Grant just dropped 20 a night for a Detroit team, and Jeremy Grant is not in the NBA. So it would have been odd if Jeremy Grant made Team USA.
Yes, it would have been extremely odd. I like this team. I enjoy this team. It's just a bunch of bucket getters who can play multiple positions with defenders. And Kevin Love.
There we go.
I think Kevin Love is going to be great on this team, man.
He has a role. Like it does feel like he's kind of grandfathered in.
Right. It was going to be Kevin Love or Mason Plumlee.
You know, it is an upset that we don't have a Plumlee on the team this year. Hey, man, Mason Plumlee was throwing some high post dots in Detroit. You know, they already got Jeremy Grant. Why not bring Plums back?
Hey, just wait. Just wait till Kevin Love throws his first outlet pass and everyone loses their mind against some country.
Some country. Wow. Love getting canceled like 25 minutes into the pod. We are here. We are here and we are inclusive here at the Dunker Spot Podcast, part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. But no, I think it's a great team. Like, this is obviously a team worthy of winning gold just based on the talent level on it. Was a little bit not surprising at all, but a little disappointing to see like James Harden name being on the team and then him kind of withdrawing. I didn't think he was going to participate anyway. So once the initial report came out that he was going to be on the team after playing with this hamstring injury, I was like, wait, I know you love ball, but let's relax a little bit. And sure enough, he withdrew. Similar deal with Chris Paul, which is also why I'm kind of keeping an eye on this Devin Booker spot, because Chris Paul's name was, there was a report that Chris Paul had accepted an invite, or that he was leaning towards accepting an invite. And then Wolves just kind of laid the hammer down and said, no, actually, this is a decision that's been has been trending this way for a few days now, which it's always funny to track like the well actually from Woj, because he's not subtle about it at all.
Oh, nah, he's coming full Woj Nowrowski.
You know what? I'll allow it. That's fine. But we'll keep an eye on the Booker spot. But I'm just looking at the roster, like they can just throw out lineups of like 6'8" to 6'10" dudes. They can just kind of switch everything and shoot. Like you're right in that. Like that's very much on brand for what I like to see on defense in particular. So, you know, sign me up for like some Middleton, Tatum, Bam, KD, and someone else. It doesn't even matter at that point.
See, here's the sad part. This is the lineup I'm looking forward to. We'll probably never see it, but I want to see Bam, Draymond, Drew, Jeremy Grant, and anyone else. Have fun. Let's see if you can score. Like, that's what I want to see. I want to see those four just cause absolute chaos.
I mean, you know, throw Tatum out there to complete the list.
It's going to be a blast.
I'm excited for it. Less exciting on the other Team USA side, Neko Gumake did not make Team USA for some reason and is now the only WNBA MVP that has not made an Olympic team.
Reasons. I saw a thread, so.
Yeah.
I want someone to love me like that. Like, I want someone to have my back like that. Just post a thread defending me at some point in my life.
No, I mean, it was well-deserved. And going through that thread, like, you list the reasons why she was reportedly told that she hadn't made the team yet, and it seems like the goalposts continue to move. And you look at the rest of the roster, and it's a very talented roster, one that I also think is going to be worthy of winning a gold medal. But I will just say, and we can pivot, I will just say there are some names that you could argue quite easily that NECA could have made the team over.
Is this Katie Lou Samuelson slander?
No, but like also, I'll never, even just looking at the bigs that made the team.
Oh, let me check their age real quick. Give me 1 second.
We don't have to do age checks, but it's just like this is Neko Gum. Okay, we don't have to do this. There are some, the bigs on the team are talented. Let me start there. But also there are some bigs on the team that don't bring the defense that NECA does, I will say. And again, NECA's a former MVP, like MVP, multi-time all-star. Like she should have a spot.
Is this Stephanie Dolson slander?
I have nothing else to add on this subject. I would just say that it's kind of a shame that Neko Gumuke did not make Team USA.
She can hoop. It's tough. I'm sorry you're not on Gumuke with this.
Yeah, that's the pivot point. That we can roll right there. That's fine. Since we are recording technically Friday morning now, but a Thursday night effectively, we did just watch Clipper Suns. As mentioned at the top of the pod, it is now a 2-1 series lead from the Phoenix Suns as the Clippers snagged game 3 with a 106-92 victory. That was some of the best defense I've seen played all postseason from anyone. And like game 2 was high-level defense on both sides. But it felt like the Clippers found another gear. Devin Booker has continued to struggle. A very healthy 5 of 21 shooting line tonight. The pressure from Terrence Mann tonight, the pressure from Patrick Beverley tonight, just the way that the Clippers kind of shrunk the floor on his drives. They're not letting him breathe out there, which is a dull thing to say when you have a star guard out there. Like, obviously, you want to shut down the number one scoring option. But, like, just how tight the rotations have been, how strong the help has been. And again, like Patrick Beverley's been picking the man up half full court. Terrence Mann is sprinkling in some possessions doing that. They'll switch sometimes. Sometimes they'll throw some trap. Like they are just mixing it up in a way that Devin Booker has not found his footing since game 1.
No, they're keeping him out of rhythm. And that's what the Clippers defense has done. It's what they did to Donovan Mitchell with the doubles. Here with Devin Booker, they're using physicality. They're using denials. They're using activity, ball pressure. And they're taking away his ability to get to his automatic reads. He's going to have to make plays that he doesn't necessarily always have to make. And it's not that he can't make them. Let's make that clear. But there's no real rhythm to them. You know, it's either or. It's either he's going to look to score or he's going to look to pass. But there's no real, you know, it's not that same rhythm we saw from him in game 1 where he was kind of leading the dance and making those plays automatically. They got into him. And they did a great job defensively. The Clippers' defense the last 2 games has been great. The Clippers' defense all postseason has been really good as far as mixing things up. Like, I've been so, I don't want to say astonished, but I've been so impressed by the fact that they can continue to mix coverages on the fly in today's NBA. Like, in today's NBA, that's tough. Like, think about the different coverages they're trying. Even when they go small, it's not an automatic switch. Sometimes they'll go under. Sometimes they'll go over. Sometimes they'll trap. Sometimes they'll switch. When they go big, finding a coverage for Zubac, you know, keeping him in a drop but rotating, stunning from the nail to take away some of the pressure. Like, that's really good stuff, and that's good buy-in. And Terrence Mann, I thought, was incredible, not just on Booker, but Chris Paul as well.
Yeah.
As far as activity, ball pressure, navigating screens, he was phenomenal. And they just got after it. And they've been getting after it for a while. But that weak side defense, the rotations, the buy-in, that's good stuff. I get excited about defense. And you know, watching the Clippers execute that was very impressive.
And I think you had a tweet about this during your game thread in which you said, I'm paraphrasing right now, but you said something along the lines of the Clippers are defending up to the reputation that they had coming in. And like, that's exactly right. Like, this is the Clippers team, oddly enough, without Kawhi Leonard right now. But this is the Clipper team that when you look on paper, you say, okay, this can be a top three, top five defense in the league just based on personnel that they have. And now you're seeing that talent rise. You know, a guy like Terrence Mann, who really cracked the rotation midway through the season and has been a mainstay, like he's making an impact on the ball. And to like you just mentioned, like it's not just that they're mixing in these schemes, like they're mixing in on the fly. It's not like they're coming in saying, oh, let's do this. It didn't work. Let's change it. It's okay. This is working well. Let's mix this in just so Devin Booker won't even have a chance to get comfortable with it. Because the thing about a ball dominant guy like Devin Booker, and I don't mean that in a negative light, but just a guy that has that kind of usage, if you show anyone that talented and with that kind of usage the same look over and over and over again, they're going to know how to beat it. It's going to be up to them to make the plays to actually beat it, but they'll at least have the understanding of, okay, this is where the help is coming from. This is what the big's doing in pick and roll, whatever. These are the spots that I can get to. These are the passes that are going to be available. It's up to me to execute. The Clippers are taking that away. Because even when they're running pick and roll, like when they go small, they had Marcus Morris out there. Like throughout this series, Marcus Morris has switched. He showed high. He's been in a drop. So like even when they go small, you don't know what the read is, which again is going to your point. Like they are taking away the automatics from him. And Devin Booker has kind of waxed between these dribbling exhibitions in which he'll, you know, take a high pick and roll, snake it, probe a little bit and wait. And then there are other possessions where he's shooting whenever he gets an opening. He'll take a high pick and roll, snake it if they're icing or whatever, snake it. He's going right into the pull-up because it's like he doesn't know if this is the right play or if this is the first good look or the good first good look in the possession he's going to get. Like he doesn't know. You can just kind of see it. Like if I don't take this, I don't know if I'm going to get a better look later. So like the comfort level just isn't there for him right now. And it's really a testament to the Clippers and the game plan.
Yeah. And they've done it in multiple ways. So it's not just when he's bringing the ball up, they've done a better job when he's coming off screens. They've done a better job when he's screening. You know, you look at the difference as when the Suns ran that horn set and Booker was screening early in the series. And now it looked like at one point that the Suns were using the Clippers' activity against them. If you're going to deny Booker, we're going to turn the corner and we're able to make plays. And now we're fighting over the screen. You still can't get it to Booker. Now you got to play out of it. So that was interesting. Now I have one question while we stay on the Clippers. Were you more impressed by the Clippers defense or that the Clippers were actually able to generate some quality looks in the half court in that second half?
I would say the defense, especially since the Suns did get Chris Paul tonight. So I was just kind of wondering like how the attention was going to shift. Cause again, they did a great job defending Devin Booker in game two as well, but it's a different thing when, you know, the second guy is Campaign, who has been very good throughout this postseason, but he doesn't garner the same kind of attention, the same kind of focus as a Chris Paul would, just because of what Paul can do as a shot maker when he has it rolling. And also the passing reads that are unlocked if you're scrambling at all. So like there's a different level of focus there. So for them to get Paul back and still have this kind of effort and lock in the way that they have been on Booker and also Paul, who did not shoot well at all, first game back, so you can give him a little bit of leeway there. But you mentioned at the top, like Terrence Mann did a great job defending him as well. Like Nicholas Batum had some nice possessions on Chris Paul. Like they mixed in who they were throwing on these guys. And then from a scheme perspective, also mix again the type of looks that they were giving both of the ball handlers, so they could never really get comfortable. It was important that the Clippers were able to generate some good looks because it was a struggle for them to do so earlier in the season. Like it felt like they were a little bit more decisive offensively. Like even with them going to their pet sets and Phoenix defending them well, just kind of driving it harder, being more intentional about attacking the paint, forcing those rotations. Didn't necessarily crack Phoenix, but it cracked them enough. It gave them enough of an opening for them to get some shots going. And like, I'm thinking it's the third quarter where they had this massive run of shot making. Like Paul George was a big part of that as well. Played great tonight on both ends of the floor. All you need is a sliver for this Clippers team. And they're able to catch a rhythm. Like Reggie Jackson has continued to make tough shots. He's also getting into those automatic reads. If he does see drop, he's able to stake and get into some pull-ups as well. So like he's starting to get some of the easier looks and not just the end-the-clock stuff that he's been good at throughout this postseason run. So it's important that they are finding that rhythm as well. But I can't get off the defense. Defense was just incredible. 92 points for this Phoenix team. I can't get past the defense. The Clippers were just incredible.
I threw you a lob and you went defense. I was surprised by that.
Was that another punt?
No, no, no. I played the cards wrong. But the Clippers offense, that's where I felt like this game was different. Because we saw them make shots in game two. They were making shots, but they weren't necessarily generating shots. When they were starting to get that ball moving, whether it was against Ayton in the drop, forcing help, kicking it out, now they're swinging into drive and kick, or when Devin Booker was in foul trouble, they put him in action, it stopped being a switch, it became a show and recover, and they were able to turn the corner and get downhill. The fact that they were able to generate those is huge, because the formula for the Clippers in the series is number one defense, number two transition, number three hope we figure out in the half court. If they can find something in the half court, that'll actually give them a margin for error in the series. Now, we'll see if this is something that carries over. But if they found something offensively and they can get the Suns in rotation, we've got ourselves a series, folks.
There we go. And just, if we could stay on the Clippers for a moment, one guy I want to shout out, like Zubac has been very good. He has found some stuff. Like, he's been very good in the drop. He's played in a deeper drop at times, but it's mostly been closer to the level of screen. Like, he's moving well. He's done a great job kind of helping cut off those driving lanes for Devin Booker when he's running high ball screens. Offensively, diving hard, crashing the glass. He's really been a lob threat. Did miss one earlier in game three, but really putting pressure on the rim that way. The screening has been great for him, which is a very nerdy thing, but whatever. Like, I've enjoyed him as I did a game thread on game two earlier today.
Are you calling out nerdy things on the dunker spot?
Yeah, like that's the joke.
We're like 30 episodes in. It's too late.
That's the joke. This is literally what the dunker spot is for.
Oh, my bad.
That was the. But no, I did a game thread on game two before game three started. And like Zubac is popping with the way that the Suns would try to ice some screen and rolls. Like, just him flipping the screens the way that he did. And not only just flipping, but flipping it in rhythm with the ball handler. So they're gaining an advantage as he's sprinkling free. And like, it just creates another pocket of space for that driver to kind of get into. Like, that continued in game three. Like, the screen setting has been very good. And again, he's really made an impact as a roller, opened up some things. So I just want to give him a shout out. Like, I was wondering heading into the series if the Clippers would start small or how much they would commit to the small ball unit since they had so much success against Utah. It's been apparent throughout this series that this is more Zubac than Batum. I still feel like there's room for Batum to play more. I think he had, 15 minutes tonight, if I could pull this up? 14 and a half minutes tonight. So I do think there are more minutes to be found there, but, like, Zubac is definitely doing his thing. Like, he shouldn't lose the starting spot at all. Like, he's done a solid job on DeAndre Ayton in those possessions, at least making him work for it.
You can go ahead. You got to salute him. I mean, he's had a tough playoff run where Luka tortured him for an entire series. And then Donovan Mitchell took that and said, hey, let me get some of that. And then and then DeAndre Ayton was like, hey, let me get some of that. And so for him to stick in, stay with the buy-in, because he was technically solid this playoffs. He's been technically solid defensively, but he hasn't gotten any of the reward for it. Mm-hmm. So for him to actually finally get that kind of performance is key. I thought he did a good job, not only in the drop as far as his timing, his activity, being able to get back in that mid-range area and contest, but the late switches kind of towards the fourth quarter against Chris Paul, I thought they were key because you don't want to give Chris Paul the switch, but you want to get to it somehow. So you take away the role, you keep him in front, try and contest. So I think he's in a pretty darn good job here as far as continuing to fight through adversity, because he could have tapped out during that Dallas series and said, you know what, I'm out. But he's still fighting.
There you go. So a question I'll pose to you as, the Suns are coming off of easily their worst offensive performance, probably of the postseason. What counters do you envision them making heading into game four on that end?
They got to play with more pace and tempo. Their pace and tempo was bad. This is not a series to strictly rely on the half court. You want to be able to execute in the half court, but they played entirely too slow. And it's not just the timing of it. It's more so the fact that, hey, why are you starting your sets with 13 on the clock? That plays into the Clippers' hands. Why are you not necessarily moving the ball after that. Give yourself a chance to open those things up. Give yourself a chance to get the ball moving. This was probably the first game of the playoffs since the Lakers series, I would say, where it felt like Phoenix couldn't find their rhythm. They couldn't find the counter. They were trying to find it. This is a team that uses multiple actions, will get things going. They couldn't find one that would exploit the Clippers D. And then they kind of just got slower and slower and slower as the game went on. And that's playing right into this Clippers team's hands. Mm-hmm. The slower you play, the more that's going to allow the Clippers to be physical, the less they're going to have to react and rotate and close out, and the less chances you have to really make them pay, put pressure on them. So I think Phoenix's tempo has to, and they've got to continue to mix. Keep mixing those actions. You know, yes, the Clippers had success guarding Devin Booker off screens. Keep doing it. Keep moving him. Keep moving him, making him a moving target. That's when Phoenix is at their best, when they're a moving target offensively. When your defense knows, hey, this is what we're trying to take away, this is what we want to do, and Phoenix doesn't necessarily let you get to it. That's been the fun of watching them this playoffs. And tonight, it just never felt like they got there. You know, Chris Paul had it going early against the drop. He was making plays, but then it didn't become a true exploit. Devin Booker never really got into a rhythm. It wasn't as much drive and kick. It was a lot of forced, contested shots late in the clock. And Phoenix can win that way, but this series needs more. Like, you got to be more aggressive. You got to kind of force the issue a little bit, put some pressure on the Clippers beyond that first level of physicality.
Couldn't agree more. And to that, made the point a little bit earlier about campaign not playing much. 4 minutes tonight, had an ankle injury. I think that kind of looms large if that's serious, because they're going to need that extra injection of energy in the shot creation. Like, his game too, even beyond the numbers, just the level of confidence, the level of energy, level of pace that he played with. Like, he was a big part of Phoenix getting into their offense in game two. Tough shot making, timely drives, added some nice playmaking reps in that game as well. Without him, you know, Chris Paul already kind of slows things down. Like, that's just the way he plays. I mean, he's a Hall of Fame point guard for a reason, so it's not like it's a bad thing. But to your point, there also needs to be a counter. And if campaign isn't there to kind of spruce things up, then off the bench, it's who for Phoenix? I mean, obviously you can stagger the stars, but like, they're going to need someone to take them off the ball at least sometimes. And like, Etuan Moore was fine in game two, but I mean, he's been fine in the series, but like, he's not a traditional lead ball handler at all. So I just wonder what those second units are going to look like if the ankle injury is a little bit more serious.
It's going to be more Chris Paul, and he'll have to kind of get more aggressive earlier. I think we'll see that in game four. I think we'll see a more aggressive Chris Paul at the start of the game, as opposed to kind of collecting the data and trying to attack at the end. But campaign being out would be huge. Just the way he plays, the playmaking he brings that second unit. Who would have thought we'd be sitting here in June talking about campaign and Reggie Jackson playing at this level? Like, I asked the question, who would shift the series more? And like, it's actually a real thing. Like, they're both balling out.
Yeah. It's been one heck of a postseason run for them. Really been a heck of a season for both of those guys. Like, they have been wildly important to what each team is wanting to accomplish. Reggie Jackson helped solidify that point guard spot as it was kind of in flux with injuries, with movement, with roster movement, with trades and stuff like that. And the shot making gets carried over into the postseason. Campaign, again, he's been – what a story for Campaign as a guy that didn't have a place in the league not too long ago and has easily been one of the best backup guards in the NBA and just had – I want to make sure I got this right – just had a 29-9 game in game two.
Of the Western Conference Finals.
Of the Western Conference Finals.
This man was waived twice. And he's producing at this level at this time of year. That's huge. Fit, opportunity, belief. Biggest keys in the NBA.
There you go. And now we can move to Bucks Hawks game.
Oh, buddy, I cannot wait. Dunkers, you are in for a treat. Who knows what we're going to get? Are we going to get Mr. AVO? Are we going to get the person who wants to choke slam Budenholzer? What are we going to get, folks?
Yes, is the best answer. It's the best answer I have. But no, the Hawks get game one, 116-113. Trae Young, man. It starts with Trae Young. 48-7-11. Like, let's start. 7 rebounds for Trae Young is a hilarious thing to read. But 48-11 for Trae Young, who did basically whatever he wanted. Up until, I guess, like mid to late fourth quarter, in which the Bucks finally commit to Giannis at the five. They downsize, they switch, and they're able to kind of force Atlanta into some less than desirable shots. But it was too late at that point. Like, even as Trae took some ill-advised pull-ups late in the fourth, like, I mean, he was already past 40 at that point. Absolutely killed Milwaukee in the drop all game long. I will dig into that a little bit deeper. Well, what were your primary takeaways from that game one?
I mean, a massive win for Atlanta. I don't know if it's a series shifter, but it's a big win. It's a message that we're here. This is a young team that's playing with a lot of confidence, and we haven't seen that confidence get shaken during that playoff run. Trae Young was incredible. Led the dance the entire night. I mean, just cut him apart. For me, I'm still shocked that Milwaukee could sit and see what Trae Young did against the Knicks and see what Trae Young did against the Sixers and then say, "Nah, we'll be good. We'll be all right." And do the same thing. Like, he is destroying drop defense, and he is bending defenses in a way that's just incredibly tough to deal with. I mean, we're talking about, he gave the complete package yesterday. Drop, okay, I'm going to the floater. Now I'm still going to mix in the lobs. So if you late commit to me, you don't know if it's floater or lob. And then if you want to mix in the unders, I'm going to go to the pull-up three. And his scoring went from keeping the Hawks in it in the first half to shifting it in the second half because he had the scoring and the playmaking. And when you give Trae Young that for this Atlanta team, it's very tough to deal with. Milwaukee, it was a mixed bag for me. It was a good fight. It was a good effort at times. They had their chances to win this game. Jrue Holiday was great. Giannis was game. It just felt, again, like they got in their own way. And they got in their way on both ends of the floor. So I'm sure you're going to touch on it, so I don't want to go too deep, but it's very difficult because here's my struggle with picking Milwaukee, which I did, was the fact that I'm assuming Milwaukee's going to do what they're supposed to do. And anytime you do that, you're in a tough spot. And so offensively, they left some food on the table. They didn't put any salt on their chicken. Chris Middleton had a rough game. Brooke Lopez can't have the same defensive impact right now. If he's guarding Capella, he's going to be in action. So it's not the same. PJ Tucker can't have the same impact defensively in this series right now. He was great against KD, but yeah, you could put him on Bogdanovich, turns water off, but nah, it was like every time it felt like they scratched the surface on what they were supposed to do, they went to another room. But before you go, I will say that this is a thing where Milwaukee, if they do one or two things better, they probably win that game.
Yeah.
And that's the tough part about this series. They're going to play better. They're going to shoot better. And they have more things they can fix. Atlanta, it may not be Trae scoring 48 every game, but this is clearly the formula. Trae has to score. Trae has to play make. Other guys have to take advantage. We got to get enough defensively.
And that's it. I mean, just off the top of my head, I mean, this is a 3-point game, but off the top of my head, there was a possession midway through the first quarter in which Giannis gets a post up. Giannis misses 2-point plate layups. Atlanta gets the defensive rebound and kind of ends there. Chris Middleton runs a pick and roll, I want to say early second quarter, gets to the rim, well designed pick and roll, gets to the rim, just misses a layup. Like, just off of that, they win the game if a layup goes down. Which, I mean, you could do that for the other side as well, but like that's how close they were with what they left on the table. And that's also, as someone that has been on this Bucks bandwagon all season.
The leader of the caboose, the conductor, captain of the Deer District.
Captain of the Deer District. But like that's kind of the weird dynamic with this Bucks team. Because you'll watch them do things or try and do things, whatever. And it's like, okay, this is low-hanging fruit. If they just do this, they'll be fine. But it is inherently problematic that the fruit is hanging low and it hasn't been grabbed. Like, that's the question. Like, if the fruit is, if it's low-hanging fruit, if it's that easy to grab, why are you not grabbing it?
I'm going to ask a question real quick before you continue to go on. Is it low-hanging fruit if you can't grab it?
That's the thing. Like, I don't think it's anything they can't grab. That's what makes it frustrating. Because as you've mentioned on this pod plenty of times, if I've mentioned on the pod, like, it's not like they're just not doing the right thing. It's extra frustrating because they will do the right thing or the preferred thing. It didn't stop. Like, I threaded the game, like, late in the fourth quarter. The Bucks have a stretch from, like, the five-minute mark. Is after Chris Middleton knocks down two pull-up jumpers, which was the hottest he had been all game long. Knocked down two mid-range pulls in a row. Didn't love the spacing on those plays at all, but that's a whole other thing. But he knocks down two mid-range jumpers. After that second pull-up from Chris Middleton, they have, like, this three-minute stretch in which everything they ran was good offense. Didn't make every shot during that stretch, but literally everything they ran. Like, empty corner pick and roll with Chris. They run their one of the ATOs, quick pitch in the middle of the floor, float. Giannis pitches it to Chris Middleton on the left corner, flows to an empty corner pick and roll. Giannis gets a lob out of it. They go Drew Giannis pick and roll. Drew had it going. You had Chris Middleton basically one pass away, so there's no tag on the roll. Like, Drew was able to get downhill, get a pull up. Giannis was able to get another lob. Like, they're doing the thing that they should. They do what they do. I mean, they do what they should. And then after the two-minute mark,
they do what they do.
Yeah, like, I don't get it. Because, like, that's why I'm so confused watching this team. And I would imagine it's, like, it's exponentially more confusion for actual Buck fans. Because, like, you will see them do it. Like, I think from a frustration standpoint, I would rather just be like, man, I wish they would try this. And just kind of leave it alone, more so than them basically teasing you with doing the right thing and then stopping for who knows why.
No, it's tough. Like, I don't understand how you have that Brooklyn series and you have the issues with Giannis screening for Drew and rolling with two guys on the weak side. And then you go to the Atlanta series and immediately go back to that same setup like it's going to work. I don't understand that. I don't understand if you go kind of slow down, pick and roll heavy, ISO heavy, attack the matchups, and Trae Young isn't really involved. You kind of have the personnel to attack that more than teams have before. Like, there's just food on the table they won't touch, and if they do touch it, that was good. I'm going to eat something else now. It's just odd. Like, the dunker spot is a good spacing mechanism, but you can't have a guard in the dunker spot and someone rolling into the dunker spot with someone spaced on the weak side. That doesn't make any sense. Even when they had their late lineup, they went small. They had PJ Tucker and Pat Connaughton. They kept putting those two on the weak side. And of course the defense is going to help, because why would I not? All your best players are over here. It's just little stuff like that. It's just like, give yourself a shot to do what you're supposed to do.
It's so simple. Like, you were mentioning the guy in the dunker spot, another guy rolling into the dunker spot. Like, this is the infamous mid-third quarter possession in which Milwaukee runs a Giannis PJ Tucker pick and roll because Trae Young is stashed on PJ Tucker, because of course he is. Milwaukee gets the switch. They get Trae on Giannis. But Pat Connaughton is already in the dunker spot. Brook Lopez is in the corner. PJ Tucker then rolls into the dunker spot. Pat Connaughton is just staring down all of this happening, and he does not relocate until PJ Tucker practically runs into him. Brook Lopez does not leave the corner. So at a certain point, I'm just watching this possession mad at everybody. I'm upset with everyone except Chris Middleton, because Chris Middleton's in the left corner. Like, he's spaced. Like, he's done his job. But it's just like, okay, if PJ's going to set this screen, like, either Brooke or Pat Connaughton needs to go to the wing immediately. Like, if Brooke lifts to the wing, Connaughton goes to the corner, PJ's in the dunker spot, cool. If PJ goes to the corner, you know, Pat Connaughton stays in the dunker spot, Brooke lifts to the wing, cool. If Pat Connaughton just automatically relocates to the wing, PJ's in the dunker spot, any of that would be fine. In which Giannis would actually have some room to, like, put Trey underneath the basket, assuming the refs don't call an offensive foul, because you know how big on small post-ups go. But, like, that is the look. If you just say in a vacuum, hey, Milwaukee, what defensive look would you like to see the most? What matchup would you like to see the most? Number one is easily, let's see if we get Trey Young on Giannis. Easily the biggest mismatch that you could exploit. And they get it and then throw up over themselves. And it's capped off by Giannis taking a fadeaway over Trey and missing it. And it's like, okay, sure, Giannis probably still should have made the shot because it's ultimately an uncontested turnaround from like 12, 13 feet. But the point I made on Twitter is like the fact that that's the shot that was really accessible to him because of what everyone else sans Chris Middleton was doing is a bigger issue. Like, Giannis could not drive to the basket because there are four bodies in the paint. And the fifth body is like a step away from the paint because it's Chris Middleton. And so you can only cheat so far because Chris Middleton can shoot the ball. Wasn't shooting well in that game, so I'm not sure how much it would have mattered. But just the principle, like, Chris Middleton's a shooter. So I just look at that possession again, like what Milwaukee ran to close out the game. I'm telling you, if you have, I guess, league pass or whatever, like, seriously, watch from, like, the 5:20 mark of the fourth quarter to, like, the 2-minute mark of the fourth quarter. Just watch what Milwaukee runs. Just watch what they run. Watch the spacing on each possession, who's handling, who's spacing. Like, just watch the process there. And I guarantee you, you will be even more upset that the Bucks lost this game. Because nothing they ran was impossible for them to run at other times. None of it. And I just don't get how they have these 5-6 possession benders and they just completely say, no, let's do something else. Like, oh, that's a... So I don't know. I just don't know what you do with that. And as frustrating as it got, they lost by 3. So it's just like, if they do literally anything better, like if Chris Middleton goes like 8 of 24, 8 of 25 or whatever in the next game, it's still bad and they still would have enough to win the next game, probably. So it's, I don't know, man. This Bucks team just, it confuses me. They're so talented. They're so talented. And like, it's never an effort issue. Like, they play hard all the time. It's just, I'm just confused. The process is just so weird with them.
You seem lost, buddy. You seem lost. My mouse died, so give me 2 seconds. Keep going, though. Keep this going.
So, I don't know. Like, I find myself frustrated with the offensive process. Like, if you're going to run a pick and roll with Chris Middleton and Giannis Antetokounmpo, like, you have to empty out the corner. That's just kind of where I'm at with it. Like, it may sound simplistic, but you have to empty out the corner if you're running Chris Giannis pick and roll. You need Giannis to roll into space. You also want Chris Middleton to have a clean window around that elbow area from the pull-up at the elbows. Like, that's where he's elite at. Like, he's an elite mid-range shooter in general. But you get him to either elbow area in particular, and he's absolutely money. So what you don't want to do is run that kind of pick and roll in the middle of the floor to where the defender can, and this is what we saw a lot earlier in the fourth quarter, they'd run Chris Giannis pick and roll, but like in the middle of the floor, and like Drew Holiday is one pass away. So whoever's guarding Drew Holiday, like this Kevin Herter sometimes they Bogdan Bogdanovic, but whoever's guarding Drew is able to just cheat down and tag Giannis on the roll and muck up that space. And then you have the guy in the strong side corner that's willing to cheat off a little bit just to kind of disrupt Chris Middleton's dribble a little bit. And it's just odd to me. Like, this is what happened on those two possessions where Chris hits back-to-back mid-range pull-ups. Like, it's great that the shots went down. But, again, like, you're able to just take away the role completely just because of where everyone else is spaced out. And that doesn't make sense to me. And then on the other side of the ball, I am just – why are they making it so easy for Trae Young? Like, if you're going to play drop defense against Trae – I can't say that I agree, but, like, fine. You can't play drop defense and have Brook Lopez, like, a step below the free throw line against Trae. I don't think you can do that.
He was beyond a step, and that was part of the issue, but keep going. I got my popcorn. Don't worry.
So, like, you can't do that. That's already problematic. You especially can't do that and have, like, P.J. Tucker guarding Trae Young on purpose. Like, that's – you. Like, the reason P.J. Tucker defending Kevin Durant and drop could kind of work is because, like, Kevin Durant is long. He can get to his spots. Like, Kevin Durant isn't, like, super fast. So, like, there isn't a large speed discrepancy between those two. So, like, theoretically, P.J. could fight over and get into the picture. Like, you saw a lot of strong but, like, late contests from P.J. because he was able to, like, catch up. If Trae gets him on the screen, like, Trae is generating like 3, 4, 5 feet of space. Like, you just can't play that kind of draw. So I'm looking at that. And then I'm also looking at the fact that there's no help near the nail. There's just no help elsewhere either. So, like, not only are you playing this super deep drop, like, basically they're playing 2-on-2 basketball in a 5-on-5 game. It's, can I get my guy into the screen? Yes, no. If I can, do I want to shoot this floater and smile? Do I want to shoot this floater? Do I want to look at the crowd before I take this floater? Do I want to shimmy before I take this floater? And it's just like, Trae doesn't have to think about anything. Like, the possessions with Bobby Portis in the game were absolutely awful for Milwaukee because, like, he's in the deep drop and, like, he's not Brook Lopez. So that's already a problem. But again, it's just like, there's nobody even pretending to stun at Trae. And on a night in which, very quietly, Atlanta shot terribly from three in game one. So on a night in which Atlanta wasn't even burning it up for three, like, Trae Young got hot at different points, and he still went 4 of 13 from three in game one. But it's just like, there was no one to even pretend to help. Like, I'll also give some credit to Atlanta because in the second half in particular, they did a great job of mixing up who was spaced where. So even if Milwaukee wanted to send help, they were going to have to send help off of threatening shooters. So that made the decision tough, but that wasn't always the case. And when that wasn't the case, Milwaukee still largely stayed at home and just kind of said, hey, whoever's defending Trae, whether that's if that's Drew, if that's Pat Connaughton, who got absolutely mixed, if it's P.J. Tucker, who also got mixed, do your best while Brook Lopez drops to like 5 feet and Trae just gets the easiest floaters alive. Something has to give. Brook's going to have to play higher up, or they're going to have to be some stunts off ball just to disrupt the cadence a little bit. Or there needs to be more switching so you don't have those windows. It has to be at least one of those three. Because otherwise, Trae, it might not be 48-11, but this is going to be a 30-12 or 30-13 series for Trae pretty easily if none of that changes.
Well, no. Yeah, I think it's got to be you have to pick your poison. And the issue is when you don't pick a poison with Trae Young, he ends up doing everything. So Milwaukee has to figure out what they can live with. You know, I think as the series went on against Philadelphia, they didn't necessarily solve the problem, but they got it to a place where they could live with it. And I think Milwaukee has to find a way to get to that point. Keeping Brook and Portis that far deep does them a disservice because essentially what's happening is they're either standing or they're trying to drop back with the roller. And as soon as they commit late, the floater or the lob is already up. So, and Trae Young is playing on that. So essentially he's taking the space, getting right to you. And depending on what's open, he's either going to float it up or lob it. And then the guards have to navigate those screens if you're going to be in a drop. which is tough, obviously, because he's shifty. So it's not necessarily like you can get into him and ride him over. He may reject. He may stop and draw a foul. So he has those counters. But they have to be able to navigate those to try and take a little bit of pressure off of the big. And as you mentioned, if there's an ability to stunt or show your body in a lane to try and disrupt the rhythm or take away some of the space he sees, you got to do that. So I think there's a mix of things that Milwaukee could do better. I don't think it has to be just a small lineup. I think you need to find a way to be able to play Brook, be able to play Portis to a degree. You have to be able to execute better in that drop. And I think just being a little higher up on the floor will have a little bit of an impact because you're going back anyways. But at least you take away a little bit of the space, give your guard a chance to maybe get back in front or at least get to the side and maybe get a contest. But it can't be what it was early. And we saw it early. It wasn't just Brook. Giannis was in a drop. Yeah. First play of the game. First play of the game. And so that was like, interesting. That's a lot of space. And that was my biggest disappointment with Milwaukee is, did you not see what Trae Young did the last two series? New York never made an adjustment, and he sent them home. And Philadelphia couldn't figure it out, and they went home too. So how do you keep saying, you know, we're just going to give you this space. We'll figure it out. No, like, I don't get that. But I think Milwaukee just has to settle in. You know, Brook Lopez is going to have to really lock in on protecting that rim, and the weak side has to do a better job of helping on the rolls. You got to take something away. Force the skip and play out of that. Make them make those plays, play out of that. I think they're going to be better off if that happens. So, but man, you are big mad. The hashtag is big mad, folks.
It doesn't make sense to me. Like, you have rangy dudes on the defense. Like, you can afford to cheat off a little bit and then close out. Again, Atlanta did not shoot well in game one. So, like, just from a, you always go process of results, or at least I do. But like, even from if you go to the results standpoint, like, these guys weren't shooting well. Bogdanovich did not have lift at all in game one. Like, that was the time to say, you know what, let's dare this dude to beat us. Cause like, he just doesn't have the juice. So I don't know. There was so much process stuff that bothered me from Milwaukee. That also bothered me in round two. Didn't bother me as much in game one because they just completely blitzed Miami. But
it bothered me in game one of round one.
I was just about to say, like, game one was bad and they eked it out. But
the Bucks fought. I'll give them credit. They fought. Looks like they were going to close that game out, and then they didn't. So I was under the impression this would be the series where the Bucks took off. You know, they survived those first two series. They come and face Atlanta, take care of their business. They're in a dogfight now. You know, you don't want to give this Hawks team more life. They already have a lot of confidence. They're playing with house money. No one thought they would be here. Mm-hmm. All they got to do is win three more games. And so it doesn't always have to be Trey. You might get a Lou Will game. You might get a Kevin Huerter game. You might get another John Collins game. You might get a Bogdanovich game. Might get another Gallinari game. Man, if he just had a little bit more, little bit more juice in those knees, man.
Shout out to PJ Tucker hitting Gallo with a crossover in the left corner and then blowing the layup, which is hilarious.
Chip that layup, boy.
And then later, Gallo absolutely puts PJ Tucker in the mixer with a behind the back that flows into a step back.
But it was a slow mix.
It was a slow mix.
Like, I honestly, I swear, the more it looks like his knees hurt, the better that shot looks. Like, when it looks like his back's not working and his knees don't work, it's cash. It's going in.
Like, it doesn't make sense to me. Speaking of which, Milwaukee can't do Jeff Teague minutes in game two. I'm sorry.
I was going to ask, is this Jeff Teague slander? But you continued on too far, and I feel like I missed an opportunity.
It's fine. It's fine. Like, I obviously watched the game live, and I was seeing people. Like, I said this on the pod. I didn't think this was going to be a Jeff Teague series. Like, it shouldn't be. But I watched the game live, and people are freaking out about Jeff Teague. And it's like, why is Jeff Teague on Drew? And I was like, let me rewatch the game. Let me see what these possessions are. Like, maybe it's a transition type thing or whatever. But like, there was one falling or miss in which Jeff Teague is matched up against Trae Young, matches up in transition early, picks him up. Trae absolutely mixes him with like a step back and drains it. Next trip down, Milwaukee makes a shot, and Jeff Teague is picking up Trae Young full court while Drew is chilling on Bogdanovich in the corner. Famously very healthy Bogdan Bogdanovich right now. And so it's a high pick and roll in which Trae loses Jeff Teague immediately. Gets some help from the big. Trae retreats. Runs another pick and roll. Loses Jeff Teague again. And knocks down his second consecutive three of the quarter. In which case, I'm just like, you know what? The people were right. I was right. Society has progressed past the need for Jeff Teague minutes in crucial playoff games. Like, this is not... this is not the time for this.
So you went full "we saw you" on Jeff Teague.
I don't know if it's that, but like, come on, man.
You better hope Jeff Teague doesn't have a 4-minute stretch of straight floaters in defense.
The Bucks better hope he doesn't have a stretch of four of floaters in defense. Could that mean Bud's going to play him some more? And what's going to happen is, like, Pat Connaughton's going to have, like, a 1-for-4 game from three. And Bud's going to be like, you know what? Pat doesn't have tonight. I'm going to trust Jeff Teague. And you know what the Hawks are going to do? They're going to score. So I think game one's enough. Like, game one's, the rotation expands. You test things out anyway. I mean, we just saw it in Clipper Suns. In which, oh, speaking of which, no DeMarcus Cousins in game three.
Yeah, you know he doesn't play game threes.
Yep. Well, there you go. The rotation shrinks as the series goes on. You figure out what works, what doesn't. Kind of hammer home.
I see what we're doing here.
You know, okay. So.
That's fine.
Oh, man. I had to sneak it in.
Did you, though?
Oh, you sound like me now. This is great.
How'd Chris Middleton do?
Didn't do well. Did not shoot well at all.
Locked up by Kevin Herter.
Eh, wasn't a great showing for him. You know, good for Kevin Herter, who
How did you turn Chris Middleton shooting 4-for-23 into a good for him for Kevin Herter? That's impressive stuff. I'm speechless.
A game high plus 15 for Kevin Herter. You know,
who's made themselves more money, Kevin Herter or John Collins?
Made themselves more money. I would say Herter probably, because like he's legitimately carried the offense for stretches. Like I don't think John Collins has made himself substantially more money. Like I still don't think he's gonna get maxed. And like that's kind of what he's wanted to prove this season. That's why he turned down the 4-year, I want to say $90 million extension. I think that was reported for the year. So like if he goes from 490 to 4105 and Herter goes from like a $12 million a year guy to like a $16 or $17 million a year guy, then I mean, I still say that's Herter.
That's fair. So do you feel like the Bucks are in trouble or the Bucks just tripped over their own feet?
It's the latter for me. Like as frustrated as I was rewatching the game in particular, because boy did they leave a lot on the table on both ends. It still took, you know, Atlanta didn't shoot well, Milwaukee shot worse from three. You got next to nothing offensively from Chris Middleton, and the shots he did make came with like bad process on offense, but whatever. I'm not gonna rehash that again. But like you got historic level Trae. And after all of that, you had an ATO for a pull-up three for Chris Middleton to send a game in overtime. So I'm not concerned about them in the series. Like, I guess it's still your line. Like, I don't think this was a series shifter
for Atlanta. It's gonna cost you, pal.
That's fine. We'll add it to the invoice. It's all good. but no, I don't think it's a series shifter. like I said on the part we previewed the series, like I had a feeling that Ed Nettles was going to come in, take game one. But I'm still very confident in Milwaukee being the better team and having more things to exploit. It's just kind of on them to not just exploit those things, but to do so consistently. And maybe not do that right before clutch time and then completely go away from it during clutch time. But, you know, I've made that point already. So
it feels tough to lose that Drew game, though.
Yeah. Because Drew saved him with three balls. A 5-12 game from three for Drew, which means, if I'm doing math correctly, the rest of the Bucks shot 3-24 from three. 0-4 from Connaughton, 1-4 from Brooke, 0-9 from Chris Middleton. Good Lord. Like, Bobby Portis went 1-2, but that doesn't really count. Like, Drew Holiday is literally the only Buck that shot well from three with any kind of volume. So, like, even if that regresses a bit, which I would expect, like, I don't think we're going to see another offer from Chris Middleton. So, I think it balances out. Like, I still feel good about Milwaukee winning the series, but, man, game one was not great for them.
A better Trae Young play, the off the top of the backboard lob to John Collins or the shimmy shake three-point pull-up?
Oh, it's the lob. It's the lob. Like, I've seen Trae go off glass before, too. But, like, to pull that off high stakes in a postseason game, while the game is in balance, like, it's not like if he does that with Atlanta up, like, 17 to cap off an 8-0 run or something, like, okay, whatever. It's still impressive, but all right. But, like, that's still a very much a tight game, and he pulls that off on purpose, and it works. The shimmy's just kind of whatever. Like, again, Milwaukee's just playing to pick and roll 2-on-2 with no help elsewhere. Trae rejects the screen, and Drew just gives up on the play. So the shrug came because Drew gave up on it. Chris Middleton is one pass away. He just doesn't rotate over. I think he's defending Bogdanovich at that point. He doesn't come over. And Bobby Portis is the guy like, okay, fine, I'll close out to him since nobody else would. So the shimmy was cool, but, like, it was a function of, I mean – it was a good move to start, but then it was just laziness after that. So, like, there's only so much there. Trae made the lob happen. So I go with the lob.
Who are you more hopeful for in this series, Clint Capela or Brook Lopez, as far as impact goes?
That's a good question.
I'm on a heater. Like,
folks. You are, in fact, on a heater. Like, I am worried. Because, like, my answer, I want the answer to be Brooke. But, like, if Brooke's going to drop that deep, then, like, what impact is he going to have? Because Trae is more than content to take these floaters. And they're the good floaters. That's the frustrating part about how deep they're dropping without getting any help elsewhere. Like, Trae's floating into, like, these floating. Trae's get flowing into these, like, 7, 8, 9 foot floaters. Where if Brook plays it a step or two higher and then draws back, Trae's going to be forced into floaters closer to the free throw line, which he can still make because his touch is that absurd. But, like, if you got to build a boat out of those type of floaters, then that's a much better bet for your defense. He's just getting in real, like, he's still effectively getting, like, actual paint touches with his floaters. And you can't let him just waltz into those. So, like, that's mostly going to be according to scheme. Like, if Brooks plays a step higher, like, I trust what he can do offensively a little bit more. And I think he's going to have the impact defensively. He's going to help them rebound with the way he boxes out. Like, I want to say Brook. But I feel like that this question really boils down to Bud, honestly.
I am a little concerned with both of them. Capela guarding Giannis is a good idea, but it opens a lot of things up. We've seen the counters Milwaukee has when there's a big guarding Giannis. And I don't know how Brook gets back to his rim protector, weak side help role that he shifted the Miami series with and that he found a way to get to in the Brooklyn series, eventually against Bruce Brown. The only way you do it is if you put him on Collins, but I don't know if you want to do that and make Collins beat you. So I'm interested to see how those two progress in this series, because both teams need them. They both have an impact. So we'll see how that works.
I think the other option is when they sub them in anyway, like there were Solomon Hill minutes. Like, I think that's a natural hiding spot for Brook as well, because Solomon just isn't going to stretch you at all. And like, yeah, he's a fine screener in a little bit that he'll do it, but like, that's still not someone that you want to really involve in pick and roll like that. So that's also another. I'm actually interested to see if they do go Brook on Collins at some point. Because it's not an easy bet to make, because John Collins has been knocking down threes all season long. So you don't want him to get hot. But I mean, if you're really prioritizing the rim that way, then I guess from like a process standpoint, you'd rather give up the above the break threes from Collins than you would having like Clint Capella roll behind you, since there isn't a tag coming anywhere. I'm just going to get mad about the defense again.
No, don't get mad. I'm thinking more that allows you to switch Capella's ball screens, and Brooke can kind of roam, give some of that help that you're looking for. It's going to open up the three or the drive, which we saw Jeff Green take advantage of one game, but maybe you reach a point where that's how you help fix that Trae Young problem, keep Brooke on the floor. A hypothetical that may never exist.
Understandable. Until that point, watching Trae Collins pick and rolls defended by Drew and Giannis, and like, they didn't switch those until they went small in the fourth. What do you have Drew and or Giannis for, if not to switch that very action?
Sad part is the second straight series we've asked the same question.
Yeah, like, it doesn't make sense. Like, Giannis just made an all-defensive team in a year in which he played less help defense and switched more because you wanted to tinker with this. And Drew Holiday, like, he's very good at everything, but like, what makes him a special guard defender is the fact that you can switch him onto fours and like, you need no help, not even a stunt, like none. Like, this is Drew Holiday in New Orleans. Like, he's getting the Kevin Durant assignment on purpose, like, from tip, because he can bother guys on their base and stuff. Why is Giannis in a drop against that?
Nobody knows. Nobody knows the answer. Maybe he's Giannis dropped to DeCumpo.
Good Lord.
Shoot or shoot. You got to plant your feet, get a good base, get your knees under you, and let it fly.
Do you, though? What's wrong with a good dribble handoff, huh? Just letting your other teammates flourish? What's wrong with that? What's wrong with moving the ball, relocating, keeping things spaced?
Can't score that way.
What phase of the game is that? You know, who's to say? Who's to say? Only 12 minutes of Bryn Forbes in game one, which is interesting to me.
I thought this would be more of a Bryn Forbes series, but then again, only 12 minutes of Lou Williams. So this feels like the opposite of the Shamit Forbes matchup. But I expect we'll see more Forbes. This is a series you can probably get away with it a little bit more, in theory. And they're going to need him as far as being able to make shots and give that small lineup some pop, or give some of the other lineups some pop. So, and even Bobby Portis, which I know you loved his defense, but if he can come in and give you a few minutes and get back in it, I mean, you can tell he's been waiting to be able to play.
Yes.
But the defense wasn't great, but offensively, I'm prepared.
He came with – also, quick thing on Bobby Portis, as I was doing the rewatch in particular.
You mean Bobby Scordis?
Yeah, let's go with Bobby Scordis. That's fine. I am listening to the broadcast talk about Bobby Portis.
The hashtag is Big Mad, folks.
It's not even a big mad. It's a very quick point.
Oh.
But, like, this is during his first stint, in which, like, he scored a bucket that gave him 4 points. I think he had 4 points and 4 boards after he gets this put back or whatever. And one of the announcers, I'm not going to say which one it was, but one of the announcers immediately praises him and talk about how Bobby Portis was making an impact on both ends of the floor and how active a defender he had been. And I'm just like, are we not watching Bobby Portis drop to the restricted area in pick and roll? I don't get stuff like that.
I'm drawing the line at Reggie Miller slander. Sorry, pal.
I can't, like, come on. We're watching the same game. We are watching the same basketball game. Like, they are actively hunting this man in pick and roll. What is activity if you're like 12 feet away from the guy you're supposed to be? Okay. Anyway, that's all I had. Did you have any lasting thoughts here on Bucks Hawks?
I want to see what the adjustments are, because Atlanta could play better, but again, I don't know how much further you go. Like, this is the way they're going to have to win. I want to see which part Milwaukee focuses on. They got the tape, so it'll be interesting to see what did they do. Is it the lineups? Is it the coverage? They tweak some things. How do they get Middleton going? Like, again, there's so many things Milwaukee can do. I want to see what they try and focus on, because if they focus on the wrong things, you may end up down 2-0. And Nekias is going to be driving immediately to Atlanta.
Speaking of which, I will be driving to Atlanta on Sunday. I will be in the building for game three. So we'll, you know, I'm anticipating that being a game three in which the series is tied, which is going to be even more hype. But I will be in Atlanta for game three and game four. So we shall see. I'll also be there if a game six is necessary. If my prediction is correct, it won't be, but we'll just have to see.
This man can't leave Peachtree alone. Let's give it up for Atlanta's very own.
One lineup point, and then we can head to bed, I guess. It is late, or technically early on a Friday morning. I just don't think this is the series to start PJ Tucker. He just doesn't have a natural matchup among the starters.
Well, I mean, if the idea is, I'll counter. Why not? Okay. If the idea is, let's turn Bogdanovich's water off and let's have PJ Tucker hunt him, I get it a little bit. If the idea is we just won that Brooklyn series, just doesn't necessarily feel at the time to be like, yo, great job, guys. Hey, PJ, go ahead to the bench, buddy. Just for a buy-in type deal. So it may be a situation where they keep starting him, but maybe his minutes go down a little bit. It's a heart and soul type deal. It's one of those things that's tough to, again, once the toothpaste, you know, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. So you did the move and you won the series. And even though he doesn't have a natural matchup, can't really impact Trae Young, which is the guy you need to impact, you kind of want him on the floor, because, who else are you going to start?
I would start Connaughton. I go Connaughton on Herter, and if you're worried about Bogdanovich, go Middleton on Bogdanovich.
Did you not see Kevin Herter's game seven?
I did see his game seven.
I don't know if you want to do that.
I would do that. Like, especially if you're this committed to playing drop. Like, you need guys that can slither over screens and stay attached. Like, Connaughton can't guard Trae at all. Those matchups, that went awfully. Him against Herter, I feel much better about.
My issue is he's going to get hunted. Also, is that PJ Tucker slander? He can't navigate screens? Let me check his age real quick.
Okay. All right. It ain't look great against Trae. Yeah, it did look great in game one, period, for PJ on that front. It wasn't from a lack of effort. It's just he just couldn't stay attached. I just feel like PJ is your switch option in this series. And if you're not going to commit to switching, then like it gets kind of tough to place him. And then you combine that with, like, offensively, he just gives Trae so much of a hiding spot, because you're not really using PJ in actions like that. And heck, when they tried, then it turned into whatever that possession was in which Trey switches on to Giannis and it's a freaking mess.
Post him up.
Thank you for listening to this. You know what? Now I'm curious. I need to see how many post-up possessions PJ Tucker's had this season. That's how we're going to end the pod. Excuse me if you hear clicking on my laptop. We're pulling up Synergy right now. I need to see if this has happened on accident.
This is the pettiest moment in podcast history.
It probably is, but you know what? I'll own it. That's fine. Let me log into the account real quick. Hold on. Because that's not a thing that I would consider.
So what are we looking up right now?
I need to see how many post-up positions PJ's. Hold on. We're going to filter this for regular season and playoffs. I want the whole picture here.
Four. I don't know.
It can't. Hold on. Let's go to Milwaukee. We're gonna do some addition here. Wait a minute.
What a lovely end to the show this is. Nakai's Googling things.
No, this is beautiful. Okay, so he has one post-up in Milwaukee.
Watch it. Did he score? go click on it.
He did score. There it is.
What's the PPP, buddy?
The PPP is two. How about that? What did he do in Houston? Let's see. We're gonna make sure. Post Savant PJ Tucker. Wait a minute. No post up in Houston. So
he's one for one.
He's one for one. Yeah. I'm going to post the PJ Tucker clip on the timeline in the morning. That'll be the one.
One more for the good guys.
There it is. There it is. Good. A genuine good for him. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, we are there. You can find me on Twitter at NakaiasNBA. You can find Steve Jones Jr. at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all later.
Why don't you mind your own business?